Well, hey, everybody, welcome to another Canine Mind Freak episode brought to you by Canines on Duty. I am Brian, and today with me, I have two awesome ladies that I've been chatting with. We have Janice Baker and Trinity. How do you say your last name, Trinity?
Mar.
And they both work for the Veterinary Tactical Group. And we'll start with Dr. Baker. Dr. Baker, you are a doctor of veterinary medicine with 20 years experience, but also you have 20 years of military experience. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and some of your accomplishments?
Sure. Thank you. So I have 20 years as a veterinarian, 20 years in the military. About 10 of that was on active duty, and then the rest of that's been in the reserves. And most of my active duty time was spent in special operations. I was really fortunate to be able to be assigned directly to either medical units or canine units within special operations, supporting naval special warfare and other SOCOM elements. I also have a master's degree in veterinary forensics, and wow. I'm board certified in veterinary preventive medicine. So I focus on occupational health of working dogs.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Okay, Trinity, you're up now. And Trinity, you are the operations manager for the Veterinarian Tactical Group. And of course, you and Janice work together. And you have 20 years in veterinary medical support, correct?
Yes.
What else can you tell us about yourself?
So I'm nearly complete with my education as far as getting my license as a veterinary technician. And I am looking to specialize in emergency and critical care. I've worked in general practice across several states in Texas and North Carolina. And my focus is on emergency cases that came into the clinic. So I managed a lot of those with a team behind me, even though it wasn't something we saw on a regular basis. I do specialize in austere environments from the Alaska bush all the way up to all the way down to El Paso and the Texas-Mexico border. I've trained with local law enforcement, federal law enforcement, FEMA handlers, international canine programs, and I've provided veterinary support for the International Police Work Dog Association across several different certifying events for them, and FEMA training events as well along the East Coast and across the U.S.
Very good. Very good. That's awesome. Both of you guys have a very impressive career. So it's an honor for me to be able to pick your brains about some topics that I believe that handlers, dog trainers, and even pet dog owners really need to understand about their dog. As I study the cognitive side of things and psychology, I've learned that there is a massive miscommunication between dog and human. We believe that certain things are actually true or happening. And really, some of it is biological, some of it is physiological, and some of it is just downright the dog's ability to solve problems. And the more I talk with people and my clients call me with their problems, the more I realize that people really need to be educated on some of the scientific data that says, hey, out of 90% of dogs that we tested, this is fact. So the old ideology is no longer right. And rightly so, because now as technology improves, like now, I mean, look at Dr. Greg Burns from Emory University. I mean, he's training dogs to lay calmly in an MRI machine. And so we know more about the caudate nucleus, which is the reward center of the brain, which is great. But we're not going to get too much into that today, because I really want to focus on your area of expertise and talking about some myths that a lot of people still hold on to. And I think the biggest topic that's come up recently for me, which is what led to this interview with you ladies, is that there's still a belief that if you neuter or spay a dog, you're going to see a massive shift in behavior. And Janice, that's one of the things that you brought up is, there are some changes, but it's not quite what we think that it is. So can you tell us a little bit about, first off, let's start with some contributing factors to aggression from your point of view as a doctor of veterinary medicine.
Sure. So there's a lot of things that go into aggression. One is just genetics. You know, if that line was of dogs were tended to be more aggressive, then there's going to be a little bit of a genetic component. It doesn't mean the dog's doomed, you know, it just because of the genetics, that's a contributing factor. And then of course there's socialization when it was a puppy. Did it have the opportunity to be around humans in a really positive or a negative way? And what was its experience with other dogs? Was it, you know, the dog that's taken away and put into a kennel and doesn't get to see other dogs or interact with other dogs and has limited interaction with people, they're going to miss out on that socialization. And then as they go through their life training, that's a huge contributing factor. And then just sort of random experience. And so then also there is a little bit of contribution from hormones. You know, we look at, we say, what are the traits of literally a good father or a good mother? You know, they're protective, they guard resources or they look for resources. They have this drive to do what their hormones are telling them to do, but that's just part of it. So all of those contributing factors can play an equal or sometimes an unbalanced a role in contributing to the dog's level of aggression as it gets older.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things too that we talked about in the pre-interview is head trauma. And I had brought up the idea that some breeders, they have their kids interact with the puppies and, you know, kids are going to be kids. Maybe they drop a dog on the head or maybe the dog tumbled down the stairs and smacked its head. Can you tell us a little bit about how brain injuries can affect behavior also?
Sure. And there's not really a lot of study in that in dogs, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we don't see that much head injury. Mm-hmm. But in people, for example, that have a lesion or an injury to their frontal lobe, the frontal lobe controls impulses. It contributes significantly to behavior and personality. And so in people we know that have had a head injury or a lesion in their frontal lobe, they can have things like uncontrollable laughter, even when they're not, or uncontrollable crying, even when they personally don't feel that way. Mm-hmm. They can have rage, you know, uncontrollable rage. And the interesting thing about people, the good thing about people is we kind of have a before and after gauge. We can say, I used to not be like this, and now I'm like this. And we have that degree of awareness. With dogs, we don't. We have to rely completely on what the handler or what the owner says. He used to not be like that. He's getting worse, or he's always been like that. You know, I've been that way and I'm trying to work on this problem. So we don't have the awareness that goes into understanding that. And also we don't have the scientific research on how often that happens in dogs.
Sure. Okay. So when we talk about chemicals related to aggression, this is where a lot of people believe that if I neuter or spay my dog, then I'm going to see a decrease in aggression. Why is that not really necessarily true from a medical standpoint?
So like I mentioned before, there's so many different contributing factors to aggression. So maybe the increase in testosterone or the level of testosterone that an intact male dog feels led that dog to kind of gave them a tendency to be aggressive and use aggression as a problem-solving solution. As they go through their life, if they, you know, they're ramped up because of the testosterone and there's something that they want and they learn that if I'm aggressive, I get it, or something they don't want, get away from my food, don't tell me what to do, I'm going to snap at you, I'm going to growl or show aggressive behaviors. And then they were rewarded because they got what they wanted. Mm-hmm. That's a learned behavior. And maybe the testosterone or other hormones contributed to that behavior or them choosing to use that as a problem-solving behavior. But you take away that hormone and they've still learned that task. They still know that if they want to get somebody away from them or if they don't like being told what to do or whatever the case, they can use that tactic regardless of whether they still have those hormones or not.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the biggest things that I teach in my dog psychology class is that when you do a behavior that solves a problem, even if it's not healthy, look at, I typically use the reference to people that are hooked on methamphetamines. Most likely, the psychological profile of those people, they're very sad, very depressed. And then they meet somebody that says, well, here, smoke this because this makes me feel great. And then they do, they get that dump of dopamine from the methamphetamines. And dopamine is an indicator to the body to do that again because it solved this problem. I was miserable before, I'm not now. Well, that's the same thing with aggression. So the way I'm interpreting what you're saying is it's really the high testosterone that's giving the dog a more drive to want to find a mate to reproduce. And if people are preventing the dog, let's say it's a human that's preventing the dog from doing that, they may want to solve the problem by being like, hey, how do I make them leave me alone so I can get to the honey down the street? Because like, exactly. I'm ready to date. And then they snap at the owner and the owner says, oh my God, I can't believe my own dog would do this. And they back away. Then that dog's brain is going to give them a dump of dopamine to say, hey, it worked, because now you have freedom to go get the chick's phone number.
And I think a prime example of this is, and I remember learning this 23 years ago in veterinary school, and just being, the light bulbs came on. It was the coolest thought or concept to me, is that when we have an animal, a dog, that's acting nervous, for example, somebody is coming up to it, another dog's coming up to it, and the dog raises its hackles and it growls and it shows those behaviors that it's pretty stressed about this situation. And then we pet the dog and talk to them comforting. Are we rewarding the dog for that behavior? And I think with some people or some animals, that will actually calm the dog down. But I think for a lot of them, you're basically saying, good boy, yes, you did a behavior. You chose, you were threatened, you were stressed, you showed this aggressive behavior, and in my attempt to get you to calm down, I petted you, I rewarded you, mm-hmm. and now you're like, oh, okay, I can do that if I want this reward. Or like you said, it's the dopamine dump that rewards mm-hmm. that behavior.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
I remember that clicking. Trinity and I train dogs together a lot, and I'll admit I have the worst timing with a clicker or with rewarding, and she's excellent at it. And so I was always constantly aware that I was rewarding the dogs after they, long enough right. after they did the thing we wanted to. But that's really important in the way we handle them as well. And if the dog snaps at us and our reaction is to say, easy now, good boy, is that a reward for the dog versus a, I don't want to say punishment, that's probably not the right word, but
Just to piggyback off of what Janice said, if you've got a dog on a track or searching an area or an article search or whatever, and they're more interested in going and visiting, like you said, the honey down the street, then you take away that by altering their sexual reproduction by neutering or spaying, and that helps them be able to focus on what their task at hand is a lot easier than worrying about whether or not, or the handler worrying about whether or not they're going to be distracted because there might be females in heat in the area, or the female that's working might be in heat where she's looking to get away and go find a male, or another male comes up and gets close to her and all of a sudden she's forgot what her job is because she's more interested in getting her groove on.
Yeah, so true. And I think the important thing that you ladies are bringing up here is that the testosterone or the estrogen may have been a contributing factor, but it's not solely responsible for the act of, for example, aggression. And so there's so many people that I talk to, and I've talked to other trainers like Neil Fuser, and he agrees that a lot of people still believe that it is the testosterone or the estrogen that is creating these actions. And then, because they believe that's solely responsible for it, then if I get them fixed, then it just goes away. And then they get it fixed, it doesn't go away. And then they're like, what the heck, man? I thought this was going to solve my problem.
And from a science standpoint, the control group is the very well-behaved, intact male dog, or the very well-behaved, intact female dog. Mm-hmm. And so if it were the case that testosterone or estrogen and all of the other reproductive hormones that go with it were the cause of that aggression, then wouldn't that be the case with all intact dogs? And right. Again, like Trinity said, I agree wholeheartedly that neutering or spaying, if needed, brings or takes away that one. You got 100 things on your plate that you have to worry about, and it takes away one of them. And just from a practical management standpoint, it's a pretty significant thing that's taken off the plate, that distraction, the dog wanting to run away, get out of the kennel, get out of the yard, or not focus on their job because they're worried about the, you know, getting a mate or whatever. So So I agree with Trinity, basically, that it's one thing that helps them focus, but it certainly isn't going to bring them back to a non-aggressive baseline.
Right. Well, and I think statistically speaking, the majority of dogs, at least in my 30 years experience and having my own kennels and working for other trainers over the years, I feel like a larger percentage, and I'm confident enough to say that 90% of dogs that have behaviors like aggression, it was more a learned thing, just like what you were saying. I have a high drive to go mate. You're preventing me from mating. So how do I make you go away? And that's one of the things that I really focus on. The Department of Psychology at the University of Florida states that dogs solve problems like humans and higher primates. So maybe it's the testosterone that's creating the drive to go seek out a female, but right. Now there's a barrier in their way. And so then they say, okay, well, let me try this to see if that gives me freedom to go and do that. Nope, that didn't work. Okay, well, let me try this. That didn't work. Okay, but you know, getting aggressive and biting the handler in the hand made him drop the leash or her drop the leash. And then I was able to go run and sniff and smell. But it was only, it wasn't the chemical in itself or the testosterone or estrogen that created the aggression. The aggression was just problem solving solution. And this right. is why I think there's a big disconnect with people having a belief that neutering a dog is going to solve the aggression. And that's just not the case as we've established this far.
I agree. And I think that Trinity can probably speak to this more because she's got so much more experience in general practice than I have. But for years and years as veterinarians, our job was, you know, I joked when I got out of vet school, I didn't know anything about reproduction because my job was to make sure that all dogs and cats in the world were spayed and neutered. That's, you know, the community that I came from. And we push spaying neutering to control overpopulation of animals, which I think is extremely important.
Sure.
And on the other hand, one of the arguments that we use with owners is, you know, it'll prevent medical problems, it'll keep them from running away, getting hit by a car, and it'll reduce aggression. And we say that because, and maybe we didn't mean it very literally that it will reduce aggression. It'll reduce problems associated with that. And so we push that, and that's what people learn, and that's in their mind. And even me now, 20 years on now, looking at the evidence that says that early spaying and neutering might not be the best thing for certain dogs that have to be athletic and all of that. Where I look at that evidence, it's still ingrained in me. We got to spay and neuter all the dogs because of pet population. And one of the things that'll help, it'll prevent certain cancers. It'll prevent them from running away and it'll reduce aggression. That's ingrained in our heads, even though it's not necessarily scientifically accurate.
Right. Right. Now, Trinity, what are the risks of fixing a dog too early in life? Because my impression is that testosterone is a key chemical to help bone growth and muscle growth and all that other stuff. So is there any truth to that?
There absolutely is. So the veterinary community has been classically behind on a lot of that situation because we didn't have the studies to show it. So with the lifetime studies that have recently come out in labs and Goldens and those breeds show that they do need those sexual reproductive organs to mature properly in growth and bone development and brain activity so they can actually grow a big girl and big boy brain. And they need it to be able to grow like they need to. So early spaying and neutering has been shown to stunt growth. It's been shown to actually cause more osteoarthritis issues and osteoporosis issues later on in life. So early spaying and neutering isn't as good as we thought it was to begin with. Now, like Janice said, that being said, the general population, to prevent overproduction, we do need to kind of weigh those checks and balances. For your working dog side of it, absolutely wait until they have, until the growth plates have closed. I won't even say after their first heat. I'll say when growth plates have closed, and that can be done through x-rays to make sure that your dog has been fully matured growth-wise before you alter them sexually, just because you might be missing a lot of that other stuff and causing more problems later on in life.
Now, let me ask you this. I think this is what's going to go through the minds of our listeners. You talked about the growth plates. What's a ballpark age that those go? Like, if you take 80% of the population of dogs, is it roughly around a year old, or could
it depends on the it depends on the breed of the dog. So your smaller breeds are going to mature bone-wise a lot faster than your larger breed dogs do. So I've seen growth plates close as early as 9 months, and I've seen growth plates close as late as 12 to 15 months.
Wow. That's a really good indicator right there. So it kind of gives our listeners that time frame. If they have a smaller dog, it could be around 9 months, so maybe wait a year. But maybe in bigger breeds, wait a year and a half to 2 years before you get them fixed.
Right, and that's why I'm not basing that timeline off sure. of into a heat cycle, because some breeds will come into heat at a year, 13 months old, but their growth plates might not have closed fully by that time. So right. an x-ray is really the best way to determine whether or not those growth plates have closed, and if you want to get them spayed or neutered, that might be the time to do that.
And that's done through x-rays, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, if somebody says, yeah, I really want to get my dog fixed, and I heard this podcast, I listened to the professionals tell us about growth plates, but all I remember, it was around a year old. So I think the biggest message that we need to send to our listeners is that if you think it's around that time frame where you believe that they should be fully grown, the best thing to do is go get an x-ray on those growth plates, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing that I wanted to talk about, I think we've really established a very good point that I think is just a massive concern for a lot of people as far as aggression and other behaviors. It's not necessarily due to those reproductive hormones as we once thought. But then also, you know, how do we solve it? And what are some of the advantages of fixing your dog? And Trinity, you brought that up when you talked about getting distracted on a track, because that drive is still there. So there's definitely multiple benefits to spaying or neutering your dogs. I want to kind of talk about the autonomic nervous system for a little bit. Because again, you know, focusing on psychology, specifically the belief system. And I know that handlers, trainers, decoys, and pet dog owners, they treat their animal as they believe. And where do our beliefs come? Well, from, it's we heard something from somebody that we think we trust, and it must be true. Why would they lie to me? You know, look at parents, you know, and why would mom and dad lie to me? So it must be true that, I don't know, whatever crazy thing you can think of. I usually relate this to all the different religions. You know, if we all believe that there's one superpower, then why is it that we have so many different rules to make peace with him or her or whatever the case is? Well, that's the whole trickle-down theory of belief. It's like playing telephone. Beliefs and specific details can get skewed over the years as that information gets passed down. And so we know, based on that information alone, that our beliefs, what we believe to be true, can be wrong. And Trinity, yesterday we were talking about what science says is the indication of heat exhaustion. And then you said, but it's already too late for that. And then you said, here's some early signs. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. So Janice's background is in heat injury. She's one of the leading researchers for heat injury in the United States. So please fill in the blanks, Janice, if I miss some of this. But what we're finding is we know in the books, in the veterinary textbooks, the handler books, it says that heat injury, if you see these signs, then your dog has heat injury, and those signs include staggering, stumbling, collapse, seizure, shock, bloody diarrhea, things like that. But what we know in the working dog world, as far as the research that we've done, is if you see those signs, it's already too late. Dogs show behavior signs before that happens that you can learn that your dog is too hot, or you can stop your dog from working before those late signs show up. And what we're seeing those signs to be is uncontrolled panting, refusal of the reward, delaying the return to the handler if you're playing ball or you're working on outing or anything like that. If your dog just doesn't care to bring anything back to you, then your dog is trying to pant to cool themselves off because they know that whenever they bring the reward back to you, you're going to throw it again. So it seems like disobedience, especially if you've done that 10 or 15 times in a row, the dog went right out there to get the ball and then brought it immediately back. And all of a sudden he's taking longer times to get back to you, and you're getting frustrated because you don't understand why that's happening, because you've just done this 20 times and your dog did it right. So
right.
A lot of handlers learn that if your dog isn't doing something that you ask it to and you don't think it's right, then you repeat that process over and over again until your dog does do it right. So a lot of handlers will continue to push that issue and make the dog bring the ball back to them as soon as they can, because they think that that's the right process for that behavior to happen, when in fact the dog is saying, dude, I'm hot, I'm tired, I need to cool down, because if I bring you whatever I have, you're just going to throw it again and I have to go chase it because I'm a pointy ear or I'm a floppy ear, and that's what I have to do.
Right. Right. Now, Janice, can you tell us a little bit about the pre-indicators that the dog is too hot? What's happening physiologically with the body? We know that they're expelling the stored water through the paw pads and evaporation from the mouth. And what's beginning to happen internally? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So when the dog is kind of at a steady state and they're not really thermally stressed, the primary way that they get rid of heat is just from radiation off the body or convection. They lie on something cool. It just kind of flows from the body. So heat always goes to something cooler. Cold doesn't transfer to something hot. Something hot transfers to something cool. So when they're just kind of hanging around, that's how they thermoregulate. As they get thermally stressed, when they're exercising, they're producing metabolic heat. That they have more heat than they can get rid of just from radiation from the body or convection. So they have to rely on panting, and that becomes the primary way that they're releasing heat, is through panting. Well, panting takes a lot of muscles, to the diaphragm, the intercostal muscles, all of the muscles of the abdomen and chest. And so you're kind of paying money to make money, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The more the dog works to pant, they're generating a little bit more heat from that muscle expenditure. And then they're getting rid of as much as they can. But that's a limited amount. So eventually the amount of heat that's building up inside the body, the blood vessels will dilate, or the peripheral blood vessels will dilate to try to release excess heat from the body. But that doesn't really contribute much to overall panting or to overall cooling. The paw pads can sweat a little bit. They have some sweat glands in the paw pads. That's why sometimes you see on hard surfaces, they leave the little paw prints. Mm-hmm. That's just sweat. But that, again, is just, it's kind of a negligible amount of cooling. The majority of their cooling has to come from panting. So let's think of something that you're doing, like working with a reward. One of the times that we see collapse from heat injury quite a bit is when a dog is doing bite work. Because they've got that big bite sleeve or whatever in their mouth, and their drive kind of overwhelms their self-preservation in a lot of cases. We all know the dog that will chase a ball till he drops. Mm-hmm. And so they've got that big thing in their mouth and they can't pant with it in their mouth, or they're chasing the ball. That's the dogs that, like Trinity mentioned, you throw the ball, they grab the ball, but then they go find a shady tree to lay under and they spit the ball out, or a little bit of shade. They're spitting the ball out, not because they don't like that reward, that the reward's the best thing in the world to them. It's because they have to get it out of their mouth so they can pant. And one of the signs that I think is just brilliant if you can observe it in your dog. You know, you throw the ball or the reward toy, they bring it back, you throw it again. Each time they run out with the same intensity and the same drive, so to speak, to get the ball, and they run back to you really fast. Now look at the dog, the difference in the, I don't mean the speed, because they're going to get slower as they get tired, but look at the intensity, their ears back, their tail out, that look in their eyes when they go out to get the ball compared to when they bring the ball back to you. There's a difference. They're more relaxed. They're not as intense coming back to you because they've got the reward, right? They're getting that dopamine dump, like you say, and all the other endorphins and things. And you throw it out again, if it's a crazy Malinois, it's going to chase that ball with the same intensity every time because that's that drive thing. That's innate. When they bring it back to you, that's when you're going to see the difference. And eventually we start seeing the dog arcing out, not coming directly back to you, spinning around you a couple times before it comes back to offer the ball back to you or offer the reward back to you. And then finally, what we'll see is the dog, for example, will find some shade or will lay down. And in one case in particular, I always talk about the trainer went up to get the ball from the dog. The dog spit the ball out between his paws. As he reached for the ball, the dog grabbed the ball like mine and ran off or trotted off. So he threw another ball. The dog dropped the one he had, reluctantly ran after that one he just threw because he's a Malinois. He has to do that. Then the dog did the spin around. He walked around the enclosure, peed on the fence, acted like he didn't know we were there, laid down, dropped the ball. And that time when the handler or the trainer went up to get the ball, the dog ignored it. And the trainer pointed out to me, this is a dog that needs to stop working. He's got uncontrolled panting. There's nothing, usually if you show the reward to the dog, it'll momentarily stop panting and look at you. Mm-hmm. This dog didn't stop panting at all. He didn't care about the reward. He was trying to seek shade in the edge of the fence. And he was disobeying the handler. The trainer had recalled him several times. The dog didn't come to him. So all of those things, like Trinity said, refusing the reward, you offer the reward and the dog doesn't want it. The uncontrollable panting. There's nothing you can do to distract the dog to stop him from panting. The disobeying the handler, or it appears like disobedience. It's just avoiding the handler. Shade seeking, which is kind of obvious for most of us. Those are all behavioral signs. And it used to be in the textbooks, they would say the first sign of heat injury is often collapse. And now, 20 years on, I don't believe that at all. The dog was showing us a lot of signs. We just didn't know what we were looking for. Those behavioral signs of, we just say, of increased thermal stress, which is normal, those will start a long time before the dog actually succumbs to a heat injury.
Well, and I think this is why it's so important to get this message out to anybody who's a dog lover, because is it possible that the dog can learn from that experience how to disobey? Can a dog, and we've seen this when I had my kennels, people would say, hey, I want those bells so my dog can paw the bell. That way I know for certain they need to go out. And I'm like, okay, if that's what you know, this is early on in my career. I was like, sure, I can do that. Next thing you know, they're calling me 3 weeks later. They're like, please make it stop. This yeah. dog is just ringing the bell because it just wants to go outside. It was just outside. And so what we find is that dogs learn that when I behaved this way, they left me alone. Or I just refused, like an undereducated person who the dog is showing the signs of heat exhaustion, the pre-indicators, like you ladies were talking about, and they keep trying, and the dog's unconscious mind says, you can't do anymore. I'm not going to allow you to do anymore. You need to ignore or you're going to die. And then an undereducated person is going to keep trying if they believe that it is rebellion and the dog continues to not do anything and maybe even snap at the handler to make them go away because they know they're not going to survive if they don't do something severe. Now we're talking about self-preservation. So can the dog learn from that and say, well, the last time I behaved this way, they ended up leaving me alone? Absolutely. That is something to consider. And so I think it's important to really listen to what you ladies are saying. Pay attention. If you notice the pre-indicators of heat exhaustion, give your dog the last reward. That way you still won in the end, but then put them up and let them cool down. Then the dog says, okay, well, all that was fair. I ended on a good note and everything's good.
And I think I don't know that much about dog training. I'll admit that. But I believe that, you know, just like certain handlers can read a dog, like a detection dog, or they can read that dog's subtle changes in behavior. Mm-hmm. Like, well, he showed a behavior change. He didn't alert, but he showed a behavior change. We need to investigate this further. I believe that a handler that's really in tune with their dog can read their dog, can learn to read their dog for signs of heat injury or signs of other lameness, you know, signs of pain. How many people say, you know, I see a dog in a clinic that's got obvious knee stifle disease or something, and they're like, well, no, he's not limping. He's not in pain. He always walks that way. Well, he always walks that way because he's in pain. And so I think that just like a handler can learn to read a dog's subtle changes in behavior for detection or whatever else, other work they're doing, I think that it's possible to learn to read those signs of thermal stress or lameness or pain or whatever is bothering the dog.
Right, right. Well, and I noticed that's a really good point too, because some dogs, like people, they have different pain tolerances. So for example, I had my show dog was a yellow lab, and at around 4 years of age, I know quite a bit about bloat just because of having kennels. And I know that the food and the water can get sloshed to the front, creating an air pocket to the back. So the food gets trapped in the stomach, twists to try to right itself, correct? Am I right on that?
I'm close. You are completely in keeping with our current understanding of bloat. The truth of it is we really don't know what causes it. But that is the air and motility and the stomach trying to fix that problem is kind of the going thought of what's going on. But scientifically, we just don't know.
Yeah. Well, I was led to believe that it's best to feed your dog, let him have a little bit of water, and then wait like an hour. Right. And so I've always practiced that because I didn't want to take any chances. Well, so that's how that was my practice with my lab from the moment we got her till the time of death. And all of a sudden one day, and it just happened to be a really bad snowstorm in Indiana. I mean, we had 4 or 5 foot drifts. You couldn't even see the road. And I let her out one night and I could see her sides expanding. And I'm like, what the heck? It can't be bloat. She hasn't been running. She ate normal. And so I put some hydrogen peroxide down her gullet and she vomited and it smelled and looked like diarrhea. And I thought, that's not normal. And then I literally, right after she threw up, I literally could see her sides expanding again. So I called my vet and they're like, you need to get her in right now. They did an x-ray and they said, that's not air. We thought it was bloat. That's not air. It's all liquid. So they cut her open and it turns out when they split her open, her stomach exploded. There was so much buildup of water.
Wow.
And it turns out, I couldn't tell you the name of the disease, but it's where the entire digestive tract just shuts down. And the only way my dog could have survived was on a machine.
But,
you know, prior to her getting cut open, I had a ball in my pocket and she still was coming up. This dog was on her deathbed and still wanting to play ball.
Right.
And so you take somebody who doesn't read their dog very good. I paid attention to the sides and I'm like, that I'm not going to throw the ball. I'm scared that if you run and hit yourself, you could explode. It just didn't seem normal to me, but I think there's a lot of complacent people, not that they're trying to be complacent to do harm to their dog. I know everybody loves their dog, but it's just, they're not trained to pick up on those little signals that are telling us that something's wrong, because oftentimes we're not going to see it in the behavior of the dog.
Right. And so you mentioned something that I think was really important and really interesting. You said, this can't be bloat. She hasn't been doing X, Y, Z.
Right.
And that's why I said, it's like, yeah, you hit it right on the nail. That's what we teach. That's what's in the textbooks. That's what everybody learns, is that feeding too soon before or after exercise will cause bloat, or gulping water will cause bloat. That's what we learn. And that's what we hold on to. Now that we're looking back to it, the science isn't really supporting those things. The initial, like, there'd be one study that said, the dogs that ate and then went and exercised really soon after, they were more likely to have bloat. Okay, we grab onto that. And for 20 years, we believe that's what causes bloat. And then another study comes along and shows exactly the opposite. One thing that's really important, I think that it's been underlying this whole conversation, is our biases, like what makes us believe a certain thing. Yeah. And you have the belief, because that's what's in the textbooks, that's what's in all the guidelines, that these things cause bloat. And your dog hadn't done any of those things, so it can't be bloat. But right. your ability to assess your dog physically and behaviorally, fortunately, overrode your bias of what should be, you know, what would cause bloat.
Right.
And so we get stuck on a lot of things, especially with things like heat injury or the neutering. I can't neuter my dog. That's going to take away his drive, his aggression, all this stuff. And we have to be able to look at the science and look at the evidence and also the experience of really experienced people, because there's something to be said. You know, science can prove a lot of stuff that turns out to not, in the field, is not really true or not really practical. But we have to be able to recognize when we're biased about a certain topic and be open to looking at the scientific evidence or the lessons learned from the field, and be willing to modify those beliefs if necessary. So I was really glad to hear that you know it can't be bloat because it doesn't meet this criteria, but then, you know what, I know my dog and this isn't right for my dog.
Yeah.
Take him to the vet.
Well, and I was just having a conversation with Master Sergeant Copeland. I just posted a new podcast today. I try to post every Friday. And that's one of the things that him and I had discussed was handler ego. And so many times we feel bad when our dog is not performing at the level of other dogs in the training group, or maybe you're doing a demo. What if you're doing a demo midsummer, your dog is showing you those signs, the pre-signs, and that handler says, oh my God, my dog looks like shit in front of all these people. And now what's the general public going to think, that I have a disobedient dog? Oh my God, case law, and oh my God, liability. And in an instant, their brain goes through this whirlwind, and then they're like, nein, fuyestas, here. And they make the dog feel terrible for really preserving itself.
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest traits, you know, we in our company, we have a recruiting course we put our team leaders through. So they become our instructors, our consultants. And they go through about 3 to 4 days of a mock deployment where everything goes wrong. They get arrested by the fake foreign government. They lose all of their stuff. They get their aid bag, their medical stuff taken away from them at the border. All this stuff happens. And we're not looking to see if they're there's dog handlers, veterinarians, paramedics, doctors. There's all sorts of people in this course. We're not looking to see if they're the best paramedic ever or the best dog handler ever. We're looking to see that when we completely kick their knees out from underneath them and make them look like idiots, how do they react? Yeah. And we're not trying to make them look like idiots, but we have a lot of funny role players and awkward situations and all that. How do they react after they've been in a cabin for 4 days without a shower and not knowing when they're going to get fed, not knowing what's going to happen next? Are they laughing and having the time of their life? Or joking about how stupid they just looked, or congratulating each other on a job well done? How are they interacting with everybody? And that's exactly what we're looking for, that sort of that lack of ego, or the ability to corral your ego when needed, and work with others and that's exactly what we're looking for. We can teach you medicine. We can teach you tactical medicine, or how to work with dogs, or whatever it is you need to do. We can't teach that. And so that's a quality, I think, that's really important. Whether you're a veterinarian, a dog handler, paramedic, whatever you're doing, if you're working in the dog industry, kind of having that self-awareness and being able to keep your ego in check is really important.
That's right. Well, and that's been one of my biggest messages, is just put a bunch of tools in your toolbox. You know, don't just have one or two techniques for training, or one or two ideas on health, or heat exhaustion or neutering. Get multiple different ideas that still are possibilities. Like, yeah, I don't want anybody to believe a fairy tale either, that, oh, well, if I wear pink underwear on Sunday and spin around 5 times on the front lawn, then my dog's going to feel better. Well, yeah, that's completely asinine and ridiculous. But we know that each, because of what you said, Janice, about science, yeah, you know, 40 years ago, that was truth as we knew it back then. But as we get more technology, as the case studies get more in depth, as we challenge prior research, we evolve and we learn more. So that doesn't mean that certain aspects of the prior research were wrong. It just means we have to put it in a different context. But there are, like, let's say, for example, are some of those indicators that are in the textbook about heat exhaustion, are they true? Yeah, unfortunately, they're just too late of indicators.
Right.
But if you're seeing those, that's still good to know, even though that's not, there's other indicators that aren't even in the textbook yet.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, people ask why do the textbooks say these things if, you know, there's the concept of ice water cooling being bad for the dog, it's going to cause more harm than good, all that. And there's no evidence to really support that. So people will ask, well, why does it say that in the textbook? And as you pointed out, that was what we knew at the time. That was, mm-hmm. there might have been one study, there might have been somebody's personal experience. That's what we knew at the time. So for the signs that Trinity mentioned, the staggering, stumbling, collapse, shock, bloody diarrhea, seizures, those are truly signs of heat injury. And why did we list those in the textbooks instead of all of those other things? Well, medical veterinary textbooks are written by veterinarians. Mm-hmm. And how many veterinarians are actually out in the field watching the dogs work? Unless right. There's a lot of veterinarians that also work with dogs. They work with dogs for their own personal experience. But for the most part, we are too busy being behind the exam table, focusing on what we see when the dog presents to us. And that is, those signs are what the veterinarian sees when the dog presents to us. Right. We weren't out in the field to see the dog spitting out his toy or going and hiding in the shade or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why. It's not that we were wrong. We're just presenting it in a context that we experience.
Right.
And I think in the last 10 years, there's been so much more of a push to include the end user, basically the dog handler, in those in that information. Mm-hmm. What are they seeing? What are we seeing in the field? Because they're the ones that are going to prevent it. They're the ones that are going to stop it. They're the ones that are going to be the first line treatment, regardless of what the condition is with the dog. Right. And so I think because of the military involvement with dogs overseas, that's kind of where it started, and then it's flowing over to civilian law enforcement and other working dog areas, but we're getting the dog handlers more involved in describing those conditions.
Right. Which is awesome, by the way. Now, for the sake of confusing our listeners, because we've talked about neutering, we've talked about advantages of neutering and spading. Then we went on to like the heat exhaustion and all that other stuff. And then we went on to bloat. But I want to circle back to the heat exhaustion because it's springtime. We have summer coming up. Right now we're quarantined. So everybody, all these dog handlers and sport dog people, they're like itching to get out there. So, you know, sure. By the time in some states, by the time the states open up and we don't have to be quarantined anymore, they're going to want to go balls to the wall, train, because now the human is excited and the dog is excited too. And I think that this is a very important topic that we should talk about before people are released and wanting to hit it hard. So what are some of the physiological things that are happening in the body when the dog, like as the dog is going into heat exhaustion compared to getting heat exhaustion compared to heat stroke, like is there a process to the organ shutting down or what's going on inside?
That's a great question. So in general, what's happening, when we talk about field medicine of any kind, we always focus on the immediate life threat. So in massive hemorrhage is an immediate life threat, airway obstruction, immediate life threat. In the heat injury, body heat is the immediate life threat. And what happens is when the temperature gets too high, and I'll circle back to that because we don't know what too high is.
Sure.
But when the body temperature gets too high, it affects certain proteins in the body, specifically the clotting factors and the proteins that are responsible for the structural integrity of the intestinal tract, and in the other organs as well, but I'll focus on those two. So the clotting factors are just proteins, and proteins are amino acids that are folded in a very specific way. They have to be, you know, it's a big line of amino acids, has to be folded up in a very specific order. And though that folding is held together by certain kinds of chemical bonds that are very sensitive to heat. So when the body temperature gets too high, those chemical bonds are broken and the protein falls apart. We basically, we call it denaturing, but the protein falls apart. Now that clotting factor that had to be in a very, very specific orientation folded up on itself isn't, it's broken. And now they can't clot their blood as much as well as they could before. And that's where we see the bleeding disorders. They get something called DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulation or coagulopathy. It's just they don't have the ability to clot their blood anymore. So they start bleeding from all these different organs. They can bleed into their lungs. They can bleed into their GI tract. They can bleed. You'll see blood come out their nose because of the problems with the lungs. All of the organs, the kidneys, the liver, can have little micro hemorrhages that we have to look at, or we have to see microscopically. And then in the GI tract, the lining of the GI tract that protects, you know, dogs have a lot of bacteria in their gut, just like we do, that are normal and they're supposed to be there, but they're not, that bacteria is not supposed to be in the bloodstream. So if the lining of the intestine gets broken down, it loses its integrity because it also is very, very sensitive to heat. Those bacteria back up into the bloodstream and cause sepsis, or wow, blood poisoning is the non-technical term for it. And they can have massive infections as well, which leads to shock and death. That's when we see the bloody diarrhea from the late signs of that. We see all sorts of bleed, bruising in the ears and the gums and in the lighter parts of their skin, you can see little pinpoint bruises. And that's from that coagulopathy, from the proteins breaking down. And then there's a bunch of other, it's a systemic inflammatory response that's pretty, that gets a little bit too sciencey for this. But it causes that systemic inflammatory response that happens all over the body. And so the problem is we don't know how hot is too hot. Sure. And in the past, we've always said, take your dog's temperature, and if it gets over a certain temperature, stop the dog, because that's at risk for heat injury. But unfortunately, it's based off of pet dogs, non-working, non-athletic dogs. And so a lot of the guidelines say stop the dog at 104. Well, my dog is 104 when I take him out of his kennel to go work. He knows, he sees the leash, he's 105 because he knows we're going to go work. And we know from numerous studies that athletic breeds of dogs that are in good condition can get up to 107, 108 and be perfectly normal. Wow. Now, the fat schnauzer on the couch, probably not. 104 is probably going to be dangerous. So we haven't established actually at what temperature that occurs, because so many factors of the dog's fitness, condition, and biochemical makeup, which can be changed by conditioning, they act as buffers to prevent those bad things from happening, basically.
Right.
So it's we can't tell, there's no physiologic number that tells us when it's safe for the dog or not safe for the dog. And fortunately, we have those behavioral things that if the dog starts to feel too hot, his body starts to feel too hot, they're going to show those behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Trinity.
So getting back to what you were leading at with everybody being home because of the lockdown, it's springtime, the possibility of heat injury, we've seen a lot more people out walking their dogs on a regular basis. And Janice touched on it with fitness and conditioning being one of the best ways to increase heat tolerance in your dog. We're hoping that we see that these dogs that are more fit because they've been walking more often not have a serious problem with heat injury when the gates are let open and everybody can go do what they want to do. Now, that being said, we're probably still going to see a lot of heat injury just because everybody's going to take their weekend warrior out and do whatever they want to do because they've saw these videos on YouTube and they want to train their dog now. But, you know, seriously. So we honestly don't know. It will be really interesting to see what happens because of the pandemic and the lockdowns and what happens after that when everybody is able to go do about as they please.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about what you guys were just talking about you take it from a human standpoint. I remember when I was in the military, if we went up into the mountains, we had an adaptation week if we could. So during that week, that's where we're running in the higher elevation or in the desert or in the jungle, and we're getting our lungs used to the lack of air or the amount of humidity that's in the air. And we do that as people. And every time there's a change to the climate, it takes us a week or two to really adapt to that massive shift. And what I think a lot of people are forgetting, and not, again, not because they're being malicious or because they want to hurt their dog. I just think it's an unconscious complacency. I know that my dog has been pacing back and forth because my dog is used to working. I'm not working my dog because of the pandemic. And I love my dog so much. I want to fulfill that need. So then they go out and there's no one coaching them to say, hey, before you go crazy with your training, do a week or two of shorter sessions, then go back in, give your dog a break. Don't do an hour-long training session in the beginning. Would you guys agree with that idea?
Absolutely. And to make a point of that, I live in a military town. I live near a huge military base, and I work in an emergency clinic in that base, or in that, not on the base, in that area. So what we see every summer, we see the returning from deployment heat injuries. So the soldier or the service member has gone off. They have a dog that they've left at home with a neighbor, a friend, a spouse, and they go, and they used to run every day with the dog, and they go off for deployment and they come back and they go out and run for the dog. Well, their dog hasn't been doing that workout with them while they were gone. And they come back, and that's a history question that we get with a lot of these cases. Did you just come back from deployment? Yes. And who's been taking care of your dog? Well, my wife, my friend, my neighbor. It's been in a kennel. And then they go out and they remember their dog as this big buddy running partner of them. And that's unfortunately happens quite a bit. So one of the easy things that it's not a guarantee, but one of the easy things that people can check is weigh your dog. If you haven't changed the amount of food he's eating, and he's at home and he's not working, he's going to have gained weight. Mm-hmm. So weigh your dog. If you have vet records or personal records of what your dog weighed before you went into lockdown and what he weighs now, if he's gained more than 5 pounds, probably gained more than 2 or 3 pounds, that's a serious indicator that your dog has lost conditioning. Muscle also builds weight or adds weight, mm-hmm. but if you haven't changed the diet, the dog's getting fed the same and it's not working as hard. I can attest to that myself. I'm eating all my lockdown snacks too quickly.
Who's not?
Yeah, right. But that's a very simple way to see if your dog might be more at risk for heat injury because of lack of conditioning. Is that, did he gain weight in that time? You know, you go out, it happens, you hurt your shoulder and you go out for 8 weeks for your shoulder surgery or your knee surgery, and your dog is at home not getting worked like he used to. And then you go back to work, or somebody takes your dog and works them. We still have in our minds, our dog is as fit as it was before that, that period of non-working. And so, a really simple thing you can do is just take a weight of your dog every week and see where he's going. Cut down on his food if he needs to, or, you know, throw the ball a little bit more in the backyard if you can.
I don't know if it's the same for women, but, you know, I'm 45, getting ready to turn 46. And man, when I go to the gym, I try to do what I used to do because I'm like, oh yeah, man, I used to do this all the time. And I feel strong and I feel mentally strong, but it's just age. That's just it. Yeah. So I've had to learn, and thank God I learned my lesson before I got an injury, because I already had a shoulder injury in my early 30s. And if I start feeling that getting aggravated, I'll drop weight, but there's still that drive to want to keep doing what I used to do. And the reason why I bring that up is because I've heard so many handlers brag about how tough their dog is. And then when the dog is showing signs, it doesn't click with them because their perception is, my dog is so tough, this can't be the problem. And they're not really consciously thinking all this stuff. I think if it's a more unconscious thing, which is why our interview today for me is super important to get this message out. really pay attention to your dog. They're actually really good communicators if you just train your brain to stop and watch the dog's behavior. Trinity, that was a great point that you brought up about, well, both of you guys discussed this, but the dog circling and the dog hesitating and not bringing this back. If you have the idea that, well, my dog is so tough, there's no, it's not that hot out to me, so it can't be heat exhaustion, you're just being a jerk, then you're gonna create more problems and potentially at the risk of your dog's life.
Yeah, it's an overestimation of the dog's fitness level is a really big risk factor in heat injury. And it goes back to the signs of heat injury that are published in the books. If the handlers learn that that's what you're supposed to look for, then they might look for any other similar signs or any other earlier signs because they're waiting for those signs that they read about before they start worrying about heat injury. So it turns into a self-fulfilling prophecy. But you're exactly right. An overestimation of the dog's fitness level is a risk factor for heat injury.
You know, I have a really good question for you ladies. It just kind of hit me. The majority of our listeners are law enforcement and military personnel. And a lot of SWAT dogs, military dogs, they have like the repelling harnesses on. Right. You know, or the stab vest or a bulletproof vest or whatnot. And so now you're talking about adding weight, adding coverage. And you that's one of the things, Janice, that you had talked about was that dogs will dissipate heat just through their skin. So now you're harnessing that.
I'm getting really excited because this is right up my alley. It's like you read my research resume and now you're
Well, maybe I did.
Yeah, maybe you did.
No, I didn't. I didn't. We just met two days ago. So I
had it's a very, very common question. And it's a great question. We see a lot of people that are reluctant to use body armor or those kinds of vests on their dogs because they're concerned about heat injury. The good thing is there's been several studies that have shown that body armor, canine body armor, really doesn't contribute much to increased body heat. Now, really? I'll caveat with those studies that so far, none of the studies have been published in the scientific peer-reviewed journals, which is kind of where, as scientists, that's where we say it's got to be there to be real. Right. But what's where it's been published and where it's been studied is basically in the military and federal law enforcement, where their publication goals in the end is not to put it out for the general population to read. It's to give that document to that agency. They contracted to do this study and the end goal is to provide this agency with guidelines. And so, being military, I have access to those things. None of them are classified. They're all unclassified. But then one was a PhD dissertation that we consulted technical consulting on for the student. Where she studied, Dr. Sarah Stosi studied canine body armor as her dissertation, which I thought was brilliant. But all of these different studies have shown that body armor, and they always studied the level 2, the small arms and slash resistant, not the level 3 with the ceramic plates. They all studied the lighter weight stuff. None of them, the dogs that wore it, they were all law enforcement dogs doing their jobs. They didn't have a clinically significant increase in body temperature, doing tracking, doing agility, doing all this. When I say clinically significant, that means did it change enough for me as a veterinarian to be worried about the temperature? And no, statistically significant, that's different. Yes, there was a change in their body temperature, but like by 0.5 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
So not clinically significant. And that's just, we attribute that to the extra weight. They're carrying 5 to 7 extra pounds on their back.
Sure.
Why don't, you know, when I wear body armor, I pretty much fall over like a turtle and can't get up and die of heat injury. when body armor is known in humans to be a significant risk factor for heat injury. So why is that not the same in the dogs? Well, going back to how do dogs thermoregulate when they're really hot? Through panting.
Yeah.
When they get so hot that they're relying almost entirely on panting, the amount of heat radiated from their body is negligible compared to what they're getting rid of panting. So when we wear body armor, we sweat, and that takes up about 50% of our body surface area and prevents it from sweating, prevents the evaporation from sweat. And so our body temperature goes up. Dogs don't sweat. They don't use that as a primary means of thermoregulation when they're hot. So we're not taking away anything that they were going to use anyway. So the increase in temperature that we see is just from doing a little bit harder work, but it's not affecting their ability to thermoregulate because that's still coming out of their mouth.
You know, I hope this isn't a silly question. This is just not my area of expertise, but does the hair follicles have an effect on dissipating heat at all that you know of?
Yeah, just to a small degree in that it contributes to the body surface area of the dog. Now, getting down to the nitty gritty of whether the other follicles or the other parts of the skin versus the hair follicles, do the hair follicles release more heat? I don't know that. I don't think we've studied that in depth in the dog's skin. All we do know is that when they get hotter, the peripheral vessels will dilate to try to get some of that heat released, but also the blood vessels in some areas will constrict to try to shunt that hot blood to the core and the core is not very well defined, but to the lungs basically so they can get it out of their body. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really know about the role of the hair follicles specifically. On that same note, though, there's a lot of discussion about do dogs with longer hair, are they more at risk? Or some people say, well, longer haired dogs, that insulates them, keeps them cooler. Some people say it makes them hotter. There's a lot of argument over coat color, whether that has it. And we just finished up some research. I can't really talk about it, unfortunately, because we're in the process of getting it published. But we just finished some research where we were comparing coat color in dogs, black dogs versus yellow dogs, and whether that contributed to heat injury, because we can't really work them until they have a heat injury. That would be unethical. Right. But just do they get hotter or do they use different mechanisms of thermoregulation? So hopefully that'll be coming out soon. We can discuss that further.
Yeah. But
there's all of those things need to be looked at. People have very strong opinions about it one way or the other, and we just scientifically we don't know.
Well, and I think a lot of human beings take it off their personal experiences. Like, for example, I thought that dogs that had thicker coats would be cooler because of my time in hot countries when I was deployed. You look at, I'll never forget the first time I was at Okinawa, Japan. Now, the temperature over there is about what it is here, like in its 80, 90s. But when you add the humidity, it feels like 120. And we called them the grass ninjas, and they were the caretakers of the base. And they just had mounds of clothes on and their faces all wrapped up. And I'm like, I'm out here in just a pair of shorts and I'm still sweating like a pig. How in the world are they doing that? So I asked my staff sergeant who'd been there multiple times, and he was like, all those layers keep them cooler in comparison. So then one would be led to believe that if they had an experience like that, that a thicker coated dog, there's more layers, of course they're going to be cooler, but that we don't know that that's actually true or not.
Yeah, we don't know. And humans, unfortunately, are a very poor model of thermoregulation in dogs and vice versa, just because we have so many different mechanisms, you know, the sweating and all of that. But and those are all great. Those are all great questions. And one of the cool things about that is that's really easy to study. And so we've been working with Southern Illinois University and some other Purdue University, some other universities over the last several years. We bring the research question, we bring the operational requirement. Hey, we really need to know if body armor is going to do this or if coat color makes a difference when selecting dogs. And then we work with those universities to do student research projects. So the graduate students and sometimes the undergrads, they actually conduct the studies and we consult and help on them. And they're great studies because they're relatively cheap. You know, if you can get a bunch of working dog volunteers to run on a treadmill or walk around in a circle in an arena, as we've recently done, and none of the dogs are harmed and it's completely safe, and you just take non-invasive measurement, you just take their body temperature, take their heart rate. A bunch of students get experience working with dogs and working with veterinarians. We get some really valuable information out of this. Mm-hmm. And this has been a joy. We've been doing this for several years now, and it's really producing a lot of practical information. We call it the VTG Institute of GWIS research. It's stuff that's not so important medically that the big universities want to study it.
Right.
So we work with some of these other universities and get students that are really interested in research, and then pair them with the dog handlers and everybody that we need to do that research. So that's been a real joy.
That's really cool. And I was happy to hear that you mentioned Purdue. That's where I was going before I moved out here to the Boston area. I was going to Purdue in Indiana for my degree. Now I'm not sure where I'm going to go. I just got all my VA paperwork transferred up to this area. So I haven't decided which school I'm going to go to yet. And of course, I have some restrictions. Like, I don't think I can go to Harvard on the Chapter 31 program through VA. I mean, I could, but there's requirements to go to someplace like that. So I have no idea where I'm going to go. But Purdue is just a really good school. They have a really good vet program. Several of the vets that I had counseled with before when I ran my kennels, they had a degree from Purdue. So that's pretty cool. And I just don't know that much about the University of Illinois or whatnot. I'm sure they're a great school. Like, really, anybody that studies animals, I think, scientific experiments, they have parameters. Like, everybody's got to follow the same guidelines. It needs to go before the review board before they even start and all that good stuff. So I think it's phenomenal what you ladies are doing and the impact that you're having to bring awareness to anybody who has a dog, but most importantly, to the people that are out there putting their life and their dog's life on the line for the safety of our communities or the United States in general, if it's military personnel. One of the things that I want to capitalize on here in closing is what you just said. We don't know, and let me know if I heard you right. We don't know for certain if darker coated dogs get heat exhaustion faster than lighter coated dogs. Is that correct?
That's correct. But it's stated in some textbooks, in a lot of review articles and informational articles, they will list dark coat as a risk factor for heat injury. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. We know that in cattle, for example, cattle that are used for milk production, they have a decreased milk production. They have signs of thermal stress more if they're dark coated compared to light coated cows. So it makes sense that, well, there's a species that clearly shows this problem. It makes sense that maybe it happens in dogs. But the truth is, we really don't know. There's been a couple of studies come out over the last few years that they weren't studying that specifically. They were studying other things, but they categorized the dogs in different coat colors. Mm-hmm. And there was a trend for darker colored dogs to be hotter. But we don't really know. So we went back and did a study specifically comparing coat color. And we controlled for all sorts of variables that they hadn't in those other studies, just because that wasn't the purpose of their study. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, we could say one thing and then another study could come along and say something different. So we're just excited to be able to put that information out there and, you know.
Yeah. Well, and that's a common thing that I've heard amongst law enforcement and military personnel. Well, I have to be more cautious because I have a dark coated dog, or I don't even want to look at a dark coated dog because they could die of heat exhaustion. And I think this is important information for people to understand that that may not be the case. I mean, obviously go with what you prefer, but scientifically there's just not enough solid evidence to say that darker coated dogs are definitely going to go down faster than a light coated dog.
You definitely shouldn't choose the dog that you get to work based off a coat color, especially if the best dog out there is a dark coated dog and not the best dog out there is a lighter color dog.
Yeah.
That should be a determining factor in what dog you work.
Yeah, that, and I'm glad you brought that up, Trinity. That's a really good point, because I think a lot of people panic over, specifically for law enforcement, military, because it's not their personal dog. And so now there's a greater risk of feeling like, as a human, well, if they're giving me the ability to choose and they're going to spend $20,000 on the dog only, man, well, what if I do pick a dog? And what if they do die a year from now? Then I just wasted the department's money. I'm going to look like a crap handler, like I make bad decisions. So some people will choose the dog that has less workability because of those underlying fears. So I'm glad you brought that up, Trinity. That was a really good point to bring up. So my question is then, in closing here, if somebody needs more researchers, like if one of the handlers or even pet dog owners are saying, hey, man, I really enjoyed this podcast, I never thought about these things, where can I go to get more information from these ladies? Do you guys have resources online? They got a website. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So we do have a website. It's www.vettechgroup.com. And you can reach me or Janice on that website. We have a Facebook page and we have an Instagram as well. If you're specifically interested in heat injury, we do have a free webinar called Rethinking Heat Injury. It's an hour and a half long where Dr. Baker deep dives into all of the research, the myths. VTG is we pride ourselves on myth busting when it comes to this kind of thing. So we want to make sure that we get the correct information out there, even if we have to say we don't know yet. So we don't want to perpetuate these myths, especially if there's a chance that they aren't true. So that's where you can get a hold of us. You can contact us on that website. Like I said, it comes to Janice or I directly. Mm-hmm. And we can't answer your question. We will find somebody in the industry that can.
That is awesome. I'm glad you told us about those resources that are available to people. And I think the more that people like you and I are doing what we're doing, let's have a discussion, let's get rid of our biases, and let's just look at what we know. I think that a lot more people are starting to understand that that's important. So I can't thank you ladies enough for spending this time with me today, bringing your expertise to the table. And it's really an honor to have this opportunity to talk to you ladies about some things that I didn't even know anything about. So this has been a really good conversation. So make sure that everybody, you go head on over to vettechgroup.com, check them out, and look for that webinar, Rethinking Heat Injury. Is that correct?
Yes, it's on our Facebook page. And if you can't find the link, then email me and I'll get it to you.
Okay. And then they have access to your email at the vettechgroup.com address, correct?
That's right. There is a contact us button on there and it takes you directly to the form to fill out to come straight to
awesome.
Us.
Awesome.
And also if you can't find that by that domain, just Veterinary Tactical Group. We're the only one.
Do a Google search, Veterinary Tactical Group. Yeah, that's awesome. So thank you again, ladies. I really appreciate your time. I know that you guys are very busy in what you guys do. You know, when I was listening to what all you guys have been involved in, I can tell you're very busy people and you really take pride in what you do. So the fact that you took some time out of your day to spend with us and our audience is just phenomenal. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. It's our pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. It was our honor.
Okay. So everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm not sure what the next podcast is going to be about. Lately I've been kind of just reaching out to people spontaneously, but definitely stay tuned. I do my best to post a new podcast every Friday. I've been doing a lot less video interviews and more focusing on the podcast, just because I'm still learning all the technology and everything else. And so, stay tuned. Next Friday, we'll have another one. Maybe it'll just be me ranting about more psychology stuff, but for this episode, it's been great to learn about the topics that we talked about. So until next time, stay safe, watch your six, and as always, Semper Fi.